This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Down to Business. My name is Jeff, and I'm recording this episode from the Mind's Eye studio just outside St. Louis in Belleville, Illinois. In today's episode, we'll explore a variety of stories from some of my favorite business publications, including Fast Company, Fortune, and Forbes. So settle in. It's time to get down to business. Our first article is from Fast Company magazine, and it's called The AI Gadget Debacle. Here's why you shouldn't expect any mind-blowing AI-powered gifts anytime soon. Most lapel pins are ornamental. Some are used to signal political or social affiliations. This one was going to change the world. When AI hardware startup Humane let me into its San Francisco headquarters in November 2023 to show off its new AI pin, the hype had been building for months. Companies across the tech ecosystem had been hinting at plans to unveil new AI-driven gadgets in the coming year, but none was more prominent than Humane. Led by former Apple executive Imran Chaudhuri, the company had raised $230 million at an $850 million valuation. As I studied the candy-colored pins arranged across tables like the product array at an Apple store, the team described the capabilities of the new wearable as post-iPhone device that could beam lasers onto your hand. I realized the company was heading for a crash when the feature they focused on the most was asking the pin for the weather. The pin was slow, screenless, and expensive, $699 plus a 24-monthly subscription. According to reports, by mid-2024, Humane had moved only a few thousand units, with returns outpacing sales. And the pin wasn't the year's only AI gadget misfire. The Rabbit R1, a fluorescent orange AI-enabled walkie-talkie, a collaboration by tech startup Rabbit and hypebeast hardware company Teenage Engineering, notched 100,000 units in pre-orders by early January. But when it shipped in April, reviewers noted that despite its playfully flashy exterior, R1's baseline AI tools, such as a smart camera, featured barely any intelligence. Many wondered why this device needed to exist when an app would do. And by September, only 5,000 people were still using their Rabbit R1s at any given time. And then there's the Friend Pendant, which promised to record every conversation in your life and send you friendly text in response. While the $99 product is yet to launch, the company spent $1.8 million of its initial $2.5 million in funding to acquire the domain name friend.com. The internet roasted the company for this pets.com-style expenditure after its website went live this past July. What was supposed to have been the year of awesome AI hardware has instead served as an empathic reminder of how far we are from a major breakthrough. Maybe our expectations have just been too high. Since computers came into our lives, there have really only been three paradigm-shifting breakthroughs in how we interact with them, iPhone designer Johnny Ive told Fast Company last year. After the original command line, we got the graphical user interface, the desktop, with all of its clickable icons and folders and, of course, the mouse. Then voice, for example, Alexa and Siri. And finally, multi-touch, the ability to tap a screen and to gesture to receive haptic feedback. Ive said that to him, the promise and excitement of building new AI hardware was that it might introduce a brand new fourth way to interact with digital devices. But we've yet to see any revolutionary new interactions from AI hardware, and in many ways, these first wave inventions seem to ignore the fact that hardware infused with AI has already been popular for years. In the last year, Americans spent $91 million on smart displays, $1.5 billion on streaming audio speakers, and $8.8 billion on stereo headphones, according to consumer insight company Circana. Most of these devices allow you to talk to an assistant or perform some level of intelligent task with only your voice. Then, of course, we have the smartphone itself, with an operating system built upon all sorts of integrated AI tools, such as the ability to analyze anything you say, improve or search the photographs you take, and even connect directly to ChatGPT via an app. All hardware includes AI in it right now, said Rabbit CEO Jesse Liu in September on stage at Fast Company's Innovation Festival. If you look at the new iPhone, that's all about Apple Intelligence, Apple's term for new assistive AI. I think for the foreseeable future, all the hardware will become AI-powered hardware in some form. But that hasn't stopped companies, including Liu's, from trying to invent new devices that harness AI in exciting ways. Sources tell me that Apple, Google, and Samsung are all working on dedicated AI hardware to launch in the next few years, and startups are racing to beat them. Yet in this urgency, the upstarts and tech giants alike can easily lose sight of the fact that they are competing not just with the gadgets of tomorrow, but with every piece of AI hardware that's come before. In other words, they can overlook all the stuff we do with our laptops and phones already. Microsoft's biggest AI move this year has been to put its Copilot AI into Windows laptops. Whether we're typing a prompt or talking to a ScarJo impersonator on ChatGPT, our laptops and phones already afford us a near-constant state of interaction with AI. In many ways, it feels like we're back in the gadget area of the mid-aughts, when experimental products like the Sony Rollie played MP3s while spinning around the living room. What's different today is that both the marketing and aesthetics of consumer electronics have become so sophisticated that even a forgettable object can appear enticing at first glance. The Rabbit R1 looks super cool. It took users a moment to realize it doesn't do anything all that new or exciting. If cell phones are any indicator of the time required to develop truly breakthrough gadgets, we can expect a lot of trial and error as AI hardware tries to find its footing. Today, it's easy to forget that early handhelds came in a wild variety of forms, evolving from those bricks with antennae you sometimes catch Michael Douglas yelling into during a movie from the 80s, to the compact flip phones and sliders that packed a full QWERTY keyboard behind their covers. These designs only coalesced into a new standard with the iPhone when the hardware itself made way for significant new UX, the touchscreen display that could shape-shift with our needs. Now designers and developers are contending with a significant new challenge. Before modern AI, all our software was deterministic, meaning it was designed to guide users through a premeditated flow that was relatively easy to test and debug. But new AI is probabilistic, meaning that it may give a slightly different answer every time. That means designing around chance. How we handle this moment is something that designers continue to debate. Can we still operate under established UX standards, or do interfaces need to constantly change to adapt to information? These are just a few of the questions the industry must resolve as it ventures toward AI hardware powered by augmented reality. Meta and Snap both continue to work on AR glasses, which float holographic images in real world. Meta's system includes a bracelet that reads the user's neurological signals and enables interaction via pinches and taps. It seems that Meta's ultimate goal is to erase the boundary between you and its AI. AI is moving us toward the kind of environmentally aware computing that's been the promise of the Internet of Things for the last quarter century. At the moment, we still feel far away from that envision. In a demo last May that went viral, Google revealed an always-watching AI camera on its smartphones that could summon an AI assistant to help a user who had lost their keys. But that's really not much of an advance over what existing AirTags can do. We are stuck in this paradigm as AI as a companion, and everything we produce becomes another friend, another peer, another little assistant, says Leonardo Giusti. His startup, Archetype, founded with Ivan Paparev, his former colleague at Google's Advanced Technology and Projects Group, has raised $13 million seed round to build an AI model of our world. Working with sensor data that's already available, the waveforms collected from microphones and gyroscopes, they can pull off some amazing feats, translating those signals to track people moving through a room, noting whether they are standing or sitting. Archetype believes it can build something that feels less like a friend and more like a real-time intuition, possibly even capable of predicting waveforms that come next, perhaps foreseeing an accident on a job site as easily as Google currently auto-completes a sentence. First Wave AI hardware has failed because it's been a distraction. We've been focused on the objects at the expense of imagining the experience AI can create. The moment we give AI a physical form, Gusti says, we're missing the opportunity to make it actually present in the world with us. In other words, as AI grows more complex, so will the challenge of wrestling the technology into any one device. In the meantime, the supercomputer in our pocket is already a pretty nifty piece of AI hardware. Our next story continues from Fast Company magazine. It's in the Culture Wars section called Brands on the Run: Why Harley-Davidson, Caterpillar, and Other Masculine Brands Are Caving to Anti-DEI Crusader Robbie Starbuck. The capitulations arrived one after another, a line of white flags growing longer by the week. First Tractor Supply Company, then John Deere, then Harley-Davidson, and Brown-Forman, the distillery giant behind Jack Daniels. And Ford followed by Lowe's and Molson Coors and, more recently, Caterpillar. Each publicly traded company, all of them household names, announced a retreat or reversal or outright abandonment of diversity, equity, and inclusion policies after facing online criticism from conservative activist Robbie Starbuck. Starbuck has been railing against so-called wokeness for years. Up until about a decade ago, he was a music video director working with the likes of Eve and Snoop Dogg, but his increasingly vocal conservative opinions didn't do wonders for his career in Hollywood. So in 2019, he pulled a reverse clampet, loading up the truck in California with his wife and children and moving to Tennessee. During the height of the pandemic, from his new perch near Nashville, he launched social media campaigns against mask and vaccine mandates. Backed by Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, he ran unsuccessfully for Congress in 2022. He produced a 2024 documentary opposing gender-affirming care called The War on Children that had been celebrated in right-wing circles and endorsed by Elon Musk. Starbuck's eager audience, more than a million followers on X, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook, laps up his diatribes against DEI. His June rant on X against Tractor Supply for sponsoring Pride festivals and committing to carbon emission reduction goals racked up 2.8 million views. His tirade against John Deere for supporting employee resource groups garnered more than 40,000 views. When Fast Company reached out to Starbuck recently to ask why he has chosen to target those particular companies for their DEI policies, he responded via email with a signal sentence, "Because I'm smart." Smart enough, alas, to know that 4 years after George Floyd's murder prompted a proliferation of corporate commitments to DEI, the cultural pendulum was swinging back. Right-wingers were incensed that one of President Biden's first official acts after his inauguration was to reverse Donald Trump's 2020 executive order banning federal agencies and contractors from conducting DEI training. The Republican Party's platform, which promises to fight against gender indoctrination and critical race theory, could very well shade our political and cultural norms in the wake of Trump's November victory. But even in this sea of right-wing aggrievement, Starbuck's crusade stands out. Like other conservative crusaders, see Stephen Miller, the American Family Association, he's going against individual companies, and while his targets span sectors, most of them have something in common. They're perceived to be masculine brands. Whether you think about Starbuck's bluster, his ability to connect the DEI movement with the supposed war on men, taps into a very real anxiety that American manhood is under attack, the same anxiety that helped decide the presidential election. While Starbuck's motivations may be political, his campaigns are succeeding because they resonate on a deeper emotional level. Richard Reeves, author of the 2022 book Of Boys and Men, and the founder of the American Institute for Boys and Men, a nonpartisan nonprofit, believes that men today are feeling socially excluded due to a variety of factors. They are increasingly distanced from their children as a result of higher divorce rates and custody agreements, he explains, and they are on the wrong end of the gender education gap, as women currently earn 58% of U.S. bachelor degrees, and they're leaving the workplace in alarming numbers and turning to drugs, alcohol, and suicide. The old script for what it meant to be a boy or a man and what role you were going to play in society has been torn up by the changes of the last 40 years, as has the old female script, Reeves says. But we haven't replaced the old male script. That leaves a lot of men adrift. In the script that Robbie Starbuck is writing, DEI initiatives are yet another mechanism that undermines men. And for Starbuck, these initiatives are especially egregious when employed by brands that have built their identities around conventional notions of masculinity. Harley Davidson must have been an especially tantalizing bullseye. The iconic 121-year-old motorcycle company made its reputation in part by positioning men as rebels and thrill seekers and women mostly as attractive ornaments for their bikes. But in recent years, the Milwaukee-based company has implemented a range of progressive initiatives, from establishing a corporate DEI department to supporting the Wisconsin LGBT Chamber of Commerce to purging pinup girl merch from its official store. Joachim Zeitz, Harley's CEO since 2020, previously served as the top executive at Puma and has throughout his career demonstrated a commitment to progressive policies, especially related to sustainability. When Starbuck launched his attack in July, a Harley dealership in Vermont countered with a long post on its website titled "Defending HD's Legacy, Exposing Robbie Starbuck's Misguided Attacks." For a moment, it looked like Starbuck might have provoked the wrong dude at the bar. Maybe a company finally had the backbone to stand up for its professed values and announced it would continue to align with the non-white male demographic that constitutes approximately 70% of the U.S. population, not to mention the very significant percentage of white American men who don't feel threatened by somebody who doesn't look exactly like them. But a few weeks later, on August 19th, Harley-Davidson caved, issuing an announcement that the company was ending its DEI commitments. Zeitz and Harley-Davidson did not respond to Fast Company's request for comment, but the company's capitulation to Starbucks speaks volumes. One crisis communication pro says companies are bowing to anti-DEI pressure because they can't confidently show the benefits because they haven't been tracking it well. In bowing to Starbucks to avoid near-term controversy that might alienate some core customers and hurt next quarter's numbers, these companies are ditching commitments to work toward more equitable futures. They appear to be operating out of fear. One reason Starbucks has been so effective is that he reduces the bait to a matter of dollars and cents. He is constantly hammering home that DEI is a losing financial proposition for companies. If DEI and supplier diversity quotas were making you money, do you really think Tractor Supply and now Harley-Davidson would drop these initiatives, he asked in one video. To those who believe in the power and value of diversity, equity, and inclusivity, the mass abandonment of DEI principles may seem like an act of cowardice, but it also may reflect the inability of companies to quantify DEI value. I think the reason that they buckle to Starbucks is because they can't confidently stand up and show the benefits because they haven't been tracking it well, says Christy File, founder and crisis communication firm Media Minefield. Even so, studies suggest that the public markets at least value these programs. A paper published in June by HOA Briscoe Tran, an assistant finance professor at the University of Alberta in Canada, found that after Florida passed the Stop Woke Act in 2022, which restricted workplace DEI programs, companies based in the state saw their stock price dip 1.8%. On average, investors in the stock market think that restricting DEI initiatives actually hurt firms' value, Briscoe transcends. Perhaps that explains why 86% of executives surveyed by Deloitte in 2023 said that embedding DEI into the workplace was important to overall success. And it's not just the C-suite that's on board. 61% of Americans said that in a recent Washington Post iPost poll that it is a good thing for companies to establish DEI programs. Numerous studies, including those published by Harvard Business Review and McKinsey, have shown a strong correlation between a diverse workforce and successful innovation. More diverse teams and more inclusive workplace environments are associated with all sorts of good things. Better innovation, better collaboration, better teamwork, better quality, better productivity, says Lily Zhang, a DEI strategist and author of Reconstructing DEI. Revanchism, it turns out, doesn't generally play. It's also quite possible that the moves companies are making to fend off Starbucks won't completely derail their DEI plans. Take John Deere. In the wake of Starbucks' pressure campaign, the farming equipment behemoth announced it would ensure training materials no longer include socially motivated messages, but also that it would continue to track in advance the diversity of its personnel. These recent DEI withdrawals are ultimately just as nebulous as some of the commitments were in the first place. Starbucks would be a fool not to realize that, but he may well not care. He has reportedly received thousands of tips from disgruntled workers hoping he'll investigate their employer next. He is, after all, a political activist, and in the culture wars, winning the narrative, or as Reeves would put it, writing the next scene of the script, is often the only victory that counts. Moving on, in our final article from Fast Company, The Future According to Google. Google DeepMind, the tech giant's internal AI research lab, isn't just racing to beat OpenAI to market. Under Nobel laureate CEO Dennis Hazabis, it's the engine room of the entire company. Google DeepMind CEO Dennis Hazabis used to get some of his most fulfilling work done between midnight and 3 a.m. A self-described nocturnal person, the Londoner devoted the solitude of his overnight shift to catching up on scientific papers, coming up with new ideas, and just plain thinking. Lately, however, even Hassabis's wee hours are in demand. Much of his team is now based at Google's home turf in Silicon Valley, where it's 8 hours earlier. As a consequence, video meetings for him often stretch into the new day. I had a really good routine until about 18 months ago, he says wistfully. His cherished quiet time was disrupted by the creation of Google DeepMind, often called GDM within the company. The organization is the result of the April 2023 merger of two existing Google AI research arms, DeepMind, which Hazabis co-founded with Mustafa Saleman and Shane Legg in 2010, and sold it to Google in 2014, and Google Brain, which Google itself formed in 2011. Hazabis was named to head the combined entity, arguably AI's most formidable brain trust. It's an enormous responsibility. Though Google has talked about being an AI-first company for years, it was OpenAI that set off the current generative AI frenzy with the November 2022 launch of ChatGPT. Google, for all its technical wherewithal, had been scrambling since then to establish itself as a leader in turning the emerging technology into actual products. It's racing against innumerable others, including Microsoft, OpenAI's flagship partner, and Suleiman's current employer. The company appointed Suleiman to head a new consumer AI unit in March in a deal that also involved it paying $650 million to license technology created by Inflection AI, the startup he co-founded after leaving Google in 2022. Google's game plan bets heavily on Gemini, a LLM named for the twin Google AI labs that came together to create it. Various versions of the Gemini technology power a raft of new features, from Google Search's AI overview, summaries to Gmail's ability to draft emails for users. Gemini has also replaced Google Assistant as Android's default voice AI, is available as a standalone chatbot, and can be utilized by other developers in their products via the Google Cloud platform. Gemini hasn't dislodged ChatGPT in the public consciousness as the AI chatbot that defines the category. And a few of Google's AI launches have turned into PR nightmares if their rough edges become obvious. Its image generator was initially capable of troubling anachronisms, such as depicting Nazi soldiers as black people. And one AI overview helpfully recommended using glue to keep cheese stuck to pizza. But Google is finally benefiting from its biggest competitive advantage, the ability to deploy AI to vast numbers of people with the flip of a switch. Every billion-user product at Google at this point has Gemini's integration, says GDM VP of Product Eli Collins, and we have 9 billion user products. As Hassabis puts it, the way it's turned out is that we're now the engine room of Google. Yet GDM's mission is even bigger than that. Like OpenAI and Anthropic and others, he's working toward achieving artificial general intelligence, or AGI. Though definitions of precisely what AGI is vary, everyone agrees it involves AI becoming more competent across more fields than anything that exists today. Legg, who helped popularize the term and is now GDM's chief AGI scientist, defines it as something that can at least match human capability in the sorts of cognitive tasks that people can typically do. Achieving it is what has prompted him, Hassabis, and Sulliman to start DeepMind 14 years ago. Hassabis's guess as to when some entity, not necessarily Google, will attain that epoch-shifting feat leaves plenty of wiggle room in both directions. He sees a 50% chance in 10 years, but says, "I wouldn't be surprised if it happened earlier." In the meantime, Hassabis, a lifetime overachiever, has been racking up the world's loftiest honors. Knighted last March in the UK for services to artificial intelligence, he is now Sir Demis. "I rarely use the title, and I'd rather other people didn't," he says. The same month, he was appointed to the Vatican's Pontifical Academy of Sciences. "I'm not Catholic myself, but they're very open-minded about discussing the philosophical implications of what's happening," he says. In October, I spoke with him hours after he and GDM Director of Research John Jumper were named Nobel Prize laureates in chemistry for GDM's AlphaFold, a breakthrough in AI-assisted protein research that could revolutionize drug discovery. Despite all of this, his career is entering a new and fraught phase. For years, he has been motivated by AI's potential to solve some of humanity's biggest challenges, a vision Google shared and allowed him to pursue with great autonomy. But now he must square that aim with the growing pressure to pump out new technologies that will keep Google's biggest products relevant. Success could hinge on his ability to balance scientific idealism with commercial reality. Google DeepMind's blocky, modernist 11-story office looms large in London's Knowledge Quarter, a thriving tech district near the British Library. The area is also home to outposts of AstraZeneca, Meta, and Samsung, along with research facilities such as the Francis Crick Institute, one of Europe's largest biomedical labs. When I visit the early October, the skies have cleared for several days of drizzle, and the sunlight streams into the conference room where Hassabis is explaining to me how hard he's worked to ensure that GDM's workplace transcends the hermetically sealed atmosphere endemic in Silicon Valley. This being a technology company, there's nothing unexpected about the fact that the room is named and decorated in tribute to Nikola Tesla, or that others honor Ada Lovelace and Alan Turing. But there are also rooms celebrating philosophers. And Mary Shelley's, whose best-known work, Frankenstein, is a 200-year tale of artificial intelligence gone awry. There's tech-inspired art on the premises, too, including two massive glass and steel polyhedrons in the lobby meant, according to the placard, to bring a rigid, gleaming tangibility to the abstraction of the numerical calculation of flawless coherence. This multidisciplinary atmosphere reflects London's rich cultural history, as well as Hassabis's own interests, which span philosophy and arts and humanities and beyond, he says. I think the same in terms of values and society, too. I feel like the world needs to input what it wants out of AI, not just 100 square miles of a patch in California. Another influence in Hassabis's most foundational one, games. Born in London in 1976 to a Greek Cypriot father and a Singaporean mother, he exhibited early signs of brilliance by trouncing his dad and uncle at chess as a four-year-old. By age eight, he's earned enough money in competitive chess to buy his first PC. By 17, he was developing video games professionally, including an amusement park simulator that sold millions of copies. In 1997, as Hassabis was graduating from the University of Cambridge with a degree in computer science, IBM's Deep Blue chess-playing computer beat world champion Garry Kasparov. Hassabis was enthralled. But the landmark moment was also a weird dead end, he says. An example of an AI construct known as an expert system, Deep Blue was hardwired for chess mastery, period. It couldn't be trained to play additional games, let alone perform other kinds of jobs. Hassabis found himself drawn to another approach to AI, neural networks. By mimicking the workings of the human brain, software built on this model could learn to do many things just as people do. The technology had been constrained by limits in computing power, but Hassabis, along with Suliman, who he'd first known as a younger brother's best friend, and Legg, a fellow researcher at the University College London, was convinced it could make strides as supercomputers grew even more capable. In 2010, the three founded DeepMind, so stealthy a startup that the original website consisted of a logo and nothing else. Early on, it created software that could learn to play 1970s Atari video games, a starting point for crafting AI that could figure out rules and goals on its own, rather than having them painstakingly coded in. Eventually, the company did the same with Go, the 2,500-year-old board game so complex that many thought a computer might never master it. But in 2016, DeepMind's AlphaGo software beat legendary Go master Lee Sedol, a bigger moment for AI than the vanquishing of Kasparov 19 years earlier. By then, DeepMind's short life as an independent company was over. A little more than 2 years earlier, Google had acquired the startup for a price reportedly between $400 million and $650 million, a pittance compared to OpenAI's current valuation of $157 billion, but not bad by 2014 standards. At the time, investors were so indifferent to AI that as a startup, DeepMind had found it very hard to raise even $10 million, recalls Hassabis, who bonded with Google co-founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin over a shared dedication to developing AI. Selling to Google meant that Demas didn't have to spend his time talking to investors all the time, says Helen King, one of DeepMind's first employees and now GDM's Senior Director of Responsibility, overseeing the safety of its work from mitigating biases in Gemini to grappling with the potential risk of AGI and other future technologies. He could focus on actually moving the research forward. Having conquered Go, DeepMind was ready to apply its AI to more substantial stuff than games. In my mind, the next step was to come out of the lab and apply it to a real-world problem, says Hassabis, and protein folding was top of my list. Identifying how proteins fold into 3D structures could provide critical insights for drug discovery and other biotechnology fields, but it was so arduous a process that only around 100,000 such structures had been determined out of the billions of possibilities. DeepMind launched an effort to automate the process and called it AlphaFold. The first version won a biannual protein predicting competition in 2018. The second, which won in 2020, was even more extraordinary advance for both biotech and AI. It also proved that DeepMind's research-first culture could thrive within Google. AlphaFold co-creator Jumper, who came to DeepMind after writing his University of Chicago PhD thesis on using machine learning for protein prediction, told me in 2021 that working there was like being at an AI conference every single day. When Google CEO Sundar Pichai ushers Hassabis on stage at the company's annual Google I/O Developer Conference in May, held at the Shoreline Amphitheater near its headquarters. It feels both overdue, Hassabis had been a Google employee for more than a decade, and yet perfectly timed, since Hassabis' work had quickly become the core to the company's future. Wearing his signature blue shirt and blue framed glasses, Hassabis tees up a video showcasing Project Astra, Google's experimental vision of a next-generation AI agent. Powered by Gemini and designed to work on a smartphone or smart glasses, Astra is no more chatbot. It uses machine vision to identify a gadget sitting on a table, in this case a music speaker, and explains how it works. It then susses out the function of encryption code displayed on a computer monitor, correctly guesses that a cartoon scrawled on a whiteboard references Schnoniker's cat, and reminds the human user where she left her eyeglasses. Aspects of Astra are due to reach consumers in some form before the end of 2024. On one level, that feels like a competitive imperative. If Google doesn't invent the world's best camera-enabled AI assistant, somebody else will. OpenAI has already previewed ChatGPT features that follow a similar trajectory, including ones that can solve handwritten math problems and get a read on a person's emotions based on facial expressions. Even Apple, despite its careful approach to AI, is giving the iPhone more camera-assisted intelligence. And yet Hassabis, who tells me he's very heavily involved in developing Astra, isn't just building a smarter AI assistant. Teaching the software to make sense of its surroundings also provides GDM with learnings critical to its quest to attain AGI. To get a computer to think like a human, he says, you can't just live in the world of languages and mathematics. You've got to understand the physical world. Yet he's not waiting to figure out AGI before proceeding on a high-potential research projects, efforts that have no bearing on Google's immediate bottom line. In 2021, it created a company known as Isomorphic Labs, or ISO for short, to commercialize the AlphaFold technologies. With Hassabis as its CEO and GDM's chief business officer, Colin Murdoch, as president. ISO now has 150 employees, standalone office space, and a focus on accelerating drug discovery, offering GDM another chance to engage with the physical world. And GDM's researchers are plugging away on other projects, taking on real-life challenges. GraphCast uses AI to produce accurate 10-day weather forecasts in less than a minute. Genome has identified 38,000 new inorganic crystals that could be useful in manufacturing everything from batteries to solar panels. Torax, developed in collaboration with the EFPL in Switzerland, is software that helps predict how to control hotter-than-the-sun temperatures necessary for nuclear fusion. Every major AI company says it aspires to bring positive change to countless aspects of life, but GDM is doing an uncommonly high percentage of the heavy lifting. This has required its staff up well beyond its computer science roots. We have some of the world's best fusion experts, biologists, material sciences, says VP of Research Pushmeet Kohli. The scope of these efforts is what then CEO Larry Page had in mind when he created Alphabet as a holding company for Google and other subsidiaries 9 years ago. He wanted to develop moonshots, new, possibly world-changing businesses that might take years to incubate and weren't necessarily tied to Google's existing successes. Today, some of these moonshots have already come and gone. Even the best known and most promising among them, Waymo's self-driving taxis, whose software GDM helped develop, has reached full commercial deployment only in Phoenix, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. But Isomorphic Labs is unquestionably an Alphabet-caliber moonshot. GDM wants to find more of them. We've got a bit of a blueprint now, says Murdoch. Tech analyst Benedict Evans points out that despite A&T's storied success with Bell Labs, it's always been tough to have a generalized innovation lab and have it spit out products. Still, Isomorphic Labs has moved past its proof-of-concept stage. In January, it announced strategic partnerships with pharma giants Eli Lilly and Novartis, which it says could result in almost $3 billion in upfront payments even before any royalties it might earn from drugs it had a hand in creating. $3 billion is not exactly a windfall for Alphabet, which made $307 billion in 2023, mostly from advertising. It does nothing to fill the company's more near-term need to imbue its existing ubiquitous Google software products with groundbreaking AI capabilities. Hecibus, however, is predicting greater things. What's better than use of AI than curing terrible diseases, he asks. But it will be incredibly valuable, I think, for Alphabet at the end of the day, too. I don't see any contradiction in that. An AI-infused note-taking tool aimed at writers and researchers might seem like the unlikeliest of candidates for 15 minutes of fame, but in late September, Google captivated users on TikTok, X, and YouTube with Audio Overview, a new feature for its free Notebook LM web app, which debuted last year. Feed it reference materials such as PDFs and web pages, and it uses Gemini to produce a podcast-like conversation on any topic between two synthetic hosts. Their dialogue is so uncannily naturally sounding, replete with ums, ahs, jokes, and digressions, that an unwitting listener might mistake it for some obscure NPR show starring real humans. Hecibus says that he was delighted by the viral reaction, which some have called a ChatGPT moment for Gemini. In science, you publish your paper, you get reviewers, and then you see the citations, things like that. This was more visceral in some ways and quite exciting. Not everybody, however, is thrilled with the tech industry's rush to develop increasingly powerful LLMs, make products based on them widely available, and edge ever closer to AGI. There's been tension inside Google, evidenced by the resignation of Geoffrey Hinton, known as the godfather of AI, and one of Google Brain's leaders, shortly after GDM was created. Hinton says he left so he could speak more freely about the dangerous road ahead. Google's recent flurry of Gemini-infused features shows that they got dragged into competing with the large language models because that's what everybody had to do once OpenAI opened that door, says Anthony Aguirre, executive director at the Future of Life Institute. The nonprofit circulated an open letter in March of 2023 calling for a six-month pause in advanced LLM development that was signed by 33,000-plus people, including three DeepMind scientists, two of whom remained at the company. And I think that's kind of unfortunate because I very much prefer the goal of designing AI to solve the problems that we actually have. Even Hecibus, according to the story in The Information published in April, had qualms about the ever-intensifying emphasis on quick commercializing AI for the masses that led to DeepMind and Google Brain being fused into Google DeepMind. Initially, I was a bit worried about compromising our research roadmap, he admits, but over time, he argues, the benefits of consolidating Google's AI expertise and the technical stack have become clearer. We were set up as a research-led company. We're still a research-led division, and that completely complementary to the impact we're having on the world. Project Astra is one example. At GDM headquarters in London, where a wall is crowded in framed posters commemorating each of the papers its researchers have published in scientific journals, Hecibus doesn't seem to have succumbed to short-term competitive pressure. One of the things he has always insisted on, and I fully agree with him, is that we should approach all of this work using the scientific method, says James Manaika, who's known Hecibus since DeepMind's earliest days and joined Google in 2022 as senior VP, focused on tech's intersection with society, reporting directly to Pichai. We should do experiments. We should be rigorous. We should publish. That's the DeepMind part of Google DeepMind, and valuing it is the first step toward preserving it. Our next submission is from Fortune magazine, entitled Who Has Time for a Power Lunch? The Real Business Happens at 4 p.m., The Power Hour, by Jane Thier. The sun is pouring in through the floor-to-ceiling windows when the bar begins to fill with bespoke suits on a Tuesday in August at 4:25. The new restaurant from Jean-Georges Vacatrain is on the first floor of a midtown Manhattan skyscraper, beneath the offices of financial giant Citadel Securities. And the traders are thirsty. This might sound like a familiar ritual, happy hour, but the trappings of that time-worn American workplace tradition, 5 to 7 p.m. drink specials, plates of chicken wings, and everyone's welcome vibe are nowhere to be found at 4:25. Here, the mostly male finance industry crowd quaffs $25 olive oil washed martinis and munches on sea urchin crostini with yuzu and serrano chilies. There are no two-for-one drink deals or discounted bar snacks. Also, it's only $4.15. This is not happy hour. This is power hour. Fong Reithin has started opening the venue earlier to accommodate this high-powered afternoon bar rush, which he says is more than making up for the decline of the Mad Men-style booze-soaked power lunch. It's all about creating a buzz, a scene with delicious cocktails and snacks. The buzz is more like a roar at 4:25, where it's hard to find a seat at the bar after the markets close at 4 p.m. A similar scene unfolds pre-5 p.m. at Le Pavilion, Chef Donald Boulard's airy outpost across the street from Grand Central Terminal and beneath the offices of real estate giant SL Green, the Carlyle Group, and TD Securities. Anthony Diamondakis, the co-head of Citi's Global Asset Managers franchise, takes a $27 bite of Jamon Ibérico and gestures with his glass of wine across the crowd, sun-drenched atrium in Le Pav. He runs a private equity group, he says, pointing at one friend and then another. He's an M&A banker at Citi. The after-work drink rush has shifted in the financial district, too, where the ritzy bar room at the Beekman Hotel is packed by 4:30. Drinks definitely start earlier and end earlier since COVID, notes bartender Pepe Conte. Before the pandemic, happy hour was an institution in decline. Buckling under the pressures of Me Too and calls for clearer division between work and personal life, the after-work tipple looked likely to go the way of the three-martini lunch. But to the relief of downtown bars and restaurants, weekday drinking seems to be making a comeback with some subtle differences. Across the country, weekday early evening drinking is actually up since pre-pandemic times, while the weekday lunch spend is down, according to data from point-of-sale system Square. That push and pull is more pronounced in cities highly indexed to office workers and knowledge economy workers, people working from home more often. That makes more sense, he says. If you're at home all day, you might actually be very eager to leave your house at 5 p.m. and go get a drink somewhere. The same seems to be true of hybrid workers going into offices 2 or 3 days a week. Many are finding that those limited in-person hours are quickly gobbled up by side meetings and collaborative work, making power lunch, or sometimes any lunch, almost impossible. After COVID, my days got so packed, says Peter Bizzelli, a manager director at the real estate firm who goes to Le Pav for afternoon drinks several times a month. The most protected time I found was at the very end of the day before I commuted home on the Metro North. When diners do come into his restaurants for lunch, Vodekreiten says that many of those these days opt for a turmeric tonic, green juice, or kombucha instead of a martini. It's rare to see someone with a glass of wine at lunch at 4:25, he says. In 1986, it was a bottle of wine at every table. But in fine dining establishments and exclusive clubs frequented by bankers and traders, the spirits and wine start flowing soon after 4 p.m. That's true whether the mood is happy or not, Matthew Niles, a bartender at 4:25, tells Fortune. Sometimes it's just been a bad day on the markets or a really good day. At either extreme, the bar is packed. So one of the bartenders usually checks the Dow to predict foot traffic, he explains. That does seem to affect us. However the markets have performed, Power Hour is generally a civilized affair, nothing like the hard partying depicted in The Wolf of Wall Street or the sweaty dance floors and pill-popping of the young traders on HBO's Industry. The finance guys moderate themselves much more than the stereotype suggests, Niles says. They've got to go home to their wives and their kids. Still, Bizzelli, the Le Pav regular, says his Power Hour bill is comfortably over $100 per visit with a generous tip on top. The truth of the matter is these drinks are great and they're expensive for a reason. You're dealing with people who have expense accounts and are within a certain strata of whatever their industry is, which is kind of a natural filter. Upstairs from Le Pav is the Centurion New York, one of a slew of new private clubs where well-heeled members can unwind after work. The exclusivity, whether enforced by a door policy or the high prices of the cocktails, is part of the draw for today's time-strapped masters of the universe, says Eugene Rem, the co-founder of Catch Hospitality Group, which owns the Manhattan restaurants Catch and Catch Steak. At traditional happy hours, young employees would follow their bosses to a local haunt for a pint, jostling for a bit of informal FaceTime. Nowadays, Rem says, the executive is going to a members club that the young 20-somethings can't get into. Leaving the office at 4 p.m. might be frowned upon by some, but the culture of the performative that kept many in the office until the late evening of a pre-pandemic has waned somewhat in the hybrid work area. And for those with the freedom to do so, a tight hour of booze-lubricated chit-chat before hopping on the train back to the suburbs can be a rather efficient way to do some high-level networking. Brazelli expenses his bar tab, which he sees as a good investment. After all, it's not just the drinks that are the premium at the power hour, it's also the people that you meet. Brazelli recalls, for example, chatting with the CEO of an AI company at Lipav. We talked about how AI is changing, how real estate is marketed, he says. I just love that. To be sure, not everyone is eager for a return to business networking in bars. More than a third of U.S. adult population doesn't drink for one reason or another, and millennials and Gen Z are increasingly choosing partial or complete sobriety. But those in the teetotaling crowd still looking to partake in power hour might fund some succor in the rise of another high-end bar trend, the non-alcoholic cocktail list. At the Beacon, for example, the abstainers can enjoy a $16 zero-proof rum, passion fruit, aquafaba, and lemon concoction any time of the day. And in our final story for this week's episode, another story from Fortune called Young People Are Drinking Less Alcohol. Can CEO Michael Doukaris persuade them to keep drinking AB InBev's beers? Some time ago, top CEOs at an invitation-only seminar at Harvard Business School were asked to imagine the four crises they would likely confront during their tenure at the top: a health emergency, a geopolitical conflict, an economic downturn, a trade war. For one participant in particular, Michael Doukaris, CEO of the world's biggest brewer, Anheuser-Busch InBev, the list hit home. So according to your research, I'm ready to retire, he recalls telling the Harvard professor, because I have seen all of that in the first 2 years. Doukaris has been promoted in July 2021 to lead AB InBev. It was a baptism by fire. Beginning at the height of COVID, when millions of drinkers were under lockdown or avoiding crowded bars, then came Russia's invasion of Ukraine, spiraling inflation, and deepening trade disputes between the U.S. and China. And in 2023, American drinkers launched a boycott against Bud Light, one of AB InBev's best-known and best-selling beers, after the company hired transgender influencer Dylan Mulvaney to promote it on Instagram. The backlash briefly clobbered AB InBev stock, and the company estimates that the boycott cost it $1.4 billion in U.S. sales. Today, Doukaris has no stated plans to retire, but he says that he gleaned an important insight at the seminar. Upheaval is the new normal. Change is coming much faster, he says, sitting one rainy morning in the AB InBev's office in Brussels, overlooking the Belgian capital's soaring 15th century city hall. The cycles are shorter than what they used to be. For AB InBev, the churn has been challenging. Analysts estimate that the company generated $60 billion in revenue in 2024, but neither its size nor its portfolio of iconic brands, which also includes Budweiser, Corona, and Stella Artois, has shielded it from economic gyrations. In the third quarter of 2024, its earnings rose, but beer sales fell about 3.1% compared with the year earlier period, thanks largely to a slump in spending in China. Doukaris and his competitors also face a potentially daunting demographic change. Younger generations are drinking far less than their parents did. Among Americans 34 or younger, the number who say they ever drink alcohol has dropped from 72% to 62% since 2000, and only 40% drink regularly, according to a Gallup poll. That change has been fueled in part by greater health consciousness. The U.S. Surgeon General's recent recommendation that alcoholic beverages carry a cancer warning label could increase customers' wariness. That means Dukaris's legacy may be determined by how well he competes in what is now one of the fastest-growing segments in the industry, non-alcoholic beer. Dukaris says that NA beers have gone from being a niche product sold largely in Europe to an everywhere-type growth, and he argues that AB InBev's is well-positioned to tap that growth because of its long-term approach to planning. He favors a 10-year plan, in fact, a practice he says he learned in China as he watched his Asian companies set up business targets decades out. If you think about non-alcohol beer as it was 2 years ago, maybe one would not invest, he says. But because we are projecting 10 years down the road, we decided to invest globally. It has been a sharp pivot for a company that became dominant by expanding rapidly through acquisitions. AB InBev is a sprawling portfolio of global and local brands, the results of having acquired beer makers in St. Louis, South Africa, Brazil, and elsewhere. AB InBev's 2016 merger with SAB Miller made it the world's biggest brewer with about 500 beers in production. Non-alcoholic beer has been the focus of a long, arduous effort within AB InBev. That much is clear inside the headquarters in Louvain, a town where monks began brewing beer more than 600 years ago, fermenting hops with water from the town's polluted river in the belief that drinking the brew made it safer to eat the fish from the water. Today, a strong yeasty aroma still emanates from AB InBev's giant facility on the riverfront. Inside its gates are vast halls and stainless steel fermentation tanks, and a sprawling tangle of 10 conveyor belts where more than 8.5 million bottles and millions more cans zip by in a blur every day 24/7. It took AB InBev until 2020 to release Budweiser Zero, its first non-alcoholic version of a big brand. DeShooter says the work involved researchers at several Belgian universities as well as at Oregon State University. Engineers experimented with sugars and enzymes, tweaking the formula so the beer could be brewed at low enough temperatures to retain its flavor and aroma. AB InBev also developed a technology to mimic beer scents. That special formula, meanwhile, sits in AB InBev's top-secret global yeast bank, a refrigerated room housing more than 2,000 yeast cultures, some dating back decades. In sub-zero temperatures, each culture is unique to a particular beer so that it can be flown to any of the company's 260 breweries, ensuring that any brand can be produced with the identical taste no matter where it is brewed in the world. The weekend I met Dukaris in Brussels, he had flown in from New York City for Belgian Beer Weekend, a blowout annual fair for which the city's central square was turned into a crowded, open-air beer hall. Inside City Hall, the Belgian Brewers Trade Association held an ornate ceremony where beer makers in red robes trimmed with fur marched solemnly through a hall hung with old tapestries. The association later bestowed a knighthood on Dukaris. The romantic trappings couldn't dispel the industry's financial worries, however. "We won't beat around the bush," the organization president told the audience. Beer companies, he said, had been hit hard by spiraling inflation, rising labor costs, and increased taxes, and several had been forced out of business. For Dukaris, the challenge will be shielding AB InBev from that maelstrom, a task made easier, he said, by focusing on a longer-term horizon. "When you project the world in 10 years, you understand things are very low today, but the compounding effect of 10 years, that represents the real opportunity."